The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Smithsonian.com. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. We're reading from Smithsonian.com. Smart news, keeping you current. New rules could determine who gets to climb Mount Everest. Nepali officials propose new requirements for obtaining a permit to climb the world's tallest mountain. By Megan Gambino. Climber Nirmal Purge's viral photograph of the traffic jam at the top of Everest this past May showed just how bad the situation had gotten. The shot was taken during the final stretch to summit the tallest mountain in the world. Hundreds of climbers had taken advantage of a stretch of good weather to begin their climb, and now they were facing dangerous delays in a location known as the death zone for its very low oxygen levels as they waited for their turn to summit. The crowds contributed to one of the deadliest Everest climbing seasons in history. This Wednesday, in an effort to increase safety, Nepali officials proposed a new set of requirements for those seeking a permit to climb the 21,035-foot peak. As Alan Arnett reports for Outside Magazine, the 59-page report stipulates that climbers would need to prove that they have summited at least one 21,000-foot mountain and that they have paid upward of $35,000 for the expedition, in addition to the current requirements of a health certificate and employing a trained Nepali guard. Expedition companies, in turn, would need to have at least 3 years' experience guiding high-altitude climbs before leading Everest trips. Everest cannot be climbed just based on one's wishes, Yogesh Bhattacharya, Nepal's tourism minister, said at a news conference covered by the New York Times. We are testing their health conditions and climbing skills before issuing climbing permits. According to Gopal Sharma at Reuters, climbers and guides raised concerns after this year's death toll of 11 climbers, 9 on the Nepali side of Everest and 2 on the Tibetan side, about inexperienced climbers receiving permits. In response, the Nepali government commissioned a panel of government officials, climbing experts, and agencies representing the climbing community to make recommendations to better regulate the process. As the Associated Press reported back in May, the $300 million that the climbing industry brings to Nepal each year is an important sum for the country, which ranks as one of the world's poorest. There are currently no restrictions on the number of Everest permits Nepal issues annually. In fact, Bhadra Sharma and Kai Schultz of the New York Times report that the number of permits granted has increased just about every year since the 1990s, leading to this year's record of 381. Exacerbating the situation, there are no limits to how many permitted climbers can make a summit bid at any given time. The timing of the expeditions is at the discretion of the guides. As is typical, this year, many of the teams leapt at the challenge to summit during a window of clear weather in late May. But with a good portion of those record-setting 381 permitted climbers, as well as Sherpas and other support people, all en route to the top, the resulting traffic jam was inevitable. It was like a zoo. Ed Doering, a doctor from Arizona who summited at the time, told the New York Times. Others described a Lord of the Flies-esque scene of climbers jostling for position, stepping around dead bodies, and desperately taking selfies at the top. According to Sharma and Schultz, the Nepali government will present the proposed changes to Parliament ahead of next spring's climbing season. We will take this forward by amending the laws and regulations, Bhattacharya, the tourism minister, told reporters. We will make our mountains safe, managed, and dignified. There's one picture with this story. I'll read the cut line. This picture, taken on May 21, 2018, shows discarded climbing equipment and rubbish scattered around Camp 4 of Mount Everest. And the stark beauty and the cobalt blue sky is in sharp contrast to that trash and debris. Megan Gambino is an editor and writer for Smithsonian.com and founded Document Deep Dive. Previously, she worked for Outside Magazine in New Mexico. This next story, the Ohio State University seeks to trademark the article The. This article is about an article. And there is a picture of a sign above some hedges that reads, The Ohio State University, established 1870. And grads of that school, make sure you pronounce the "the" by Brian Woolley. For years, the Ohio State University has held dear to its full moniker. One could charitably assume that Ohio's flagship public university, with its main campus in the capital of Columbus, feels the need to differentiate itself. According to Ohio's Board of Higher Education, the state has 14 public universities, spread across 24 regional campuses and 23 community colleges. That leaves out the more than 60 private nonprofit colleges and universities educating the young, intelligent minds of the Buckeye State. Prospective students, college football fans, alumni, employers, or really anyone could confuse Ohio State for Kent State or Wright State, both also in Ohio. But the university's insistence on emphasizing the in its name just went a step above. According to Jim Woods of the lowercase Columbus Dispatch, the university recently issued a request for a trademark to title The Ohio State University, claiming that the article The should be considered a part of the trademark when used with the full name of the institution. The application for the trademark was first revealed by a patent lawyer living in Washington, D.C. Reviewing the university's trademark application, Woods writes, the request is for a standard character trademark for the title, The Ohio State University. Some of the items covered would include T-shirts, baseball caps, and hats, according to the university's application. Unsurprisingly, the news of the application has brought The Ohio State University under some derision. As cataloged by columnist Ted Decker, also of the Dispatch, the latest push to become the best darn brand in the land drew some chuckles and eye rolls, and probably even a few guffaws. Decker noted that Ohio University, another public research university in the state, tweeted, "Good morning from the first university in the state of Ohio." Longtime rival, the University of Michigan, unsurprisingly joined in on the pile-on, with a tweet suggesting it should try to trademark the of. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the government agency that determines such matters of intellectual property, says a trademark or service mark includes any word, name, symbol, device, or any combination used or intended to be used to identify and distinguish the goods slash services of one seller or provider from those of another, and to indicate the source of the goods slash services. In a press statement issued by the Ohio State University's Communications Department and published by the Associated Press, spokesperson Chris Davey confirmed the application, arguing that the school works to vigorously protect the university's brand and trademarks. The AP also notes that the Ohio State University had previously secured other trademarks, including names of football coaches Woody Hayes and Urban Meyer. In 2017, according to Mark Cooper at Tulsa World, the Ohio State University attempted to trademark OSU, only to see Oklahoma State University, which also refers to itself as OSU, file an appeal and objection. An earlier agreement from the 1970s had drawn geographic boundaries around where each institution held the trademark. But with the web flattening out such distinctions, they reached a new agreement that there is no likelihood of confusion, mistake, or deception between the two OSUs. The USPTO will determine the validity of the Ohio State University's claim, but even if it does grant the trademark, it will be up to the school to enforce it. Until then, however, you're free to use the as you please. And that was written by Brian Holey, who is the digital editor of Smithsonian.com. And I imagine he had some fun researching that. Next up, Ice Age humans likely played major role in cave bears' extinction. Researchers have long debated whether human activity or climate change precipitated the species' demise. By Milian Soley, Smithsonian.com. Giant cave bears weighing up to 2,000 pounds roamed the European continent for more than 100,000 years. But around 20 years ago, the species, officially known as Ursus spileus, died out under still mysterious and oft-debated circumstances. A new study published in the journal Scientific Reports outlines a convincing explanation for the cave bear's demise. As Tim Berneman reports for National Geographic, researchers led by the University of Zurich's Verona Schumann used mitochondrial DNA from 59 cave bears' remains to date the start of the species' decline to some 40,000 years ago, long before the advent of the last ice age, but right around the time that modern humans began settling in Europe. The team's findings support one of two leading theories regarding the animal's downfall, suggesting that Homo sapiens, as opposed to climate change, largely precipitated the end of the cave bear. If not for our arrival in Europe, I don't see any reason why cave bears should not be around today, study co-author Hervé Boscherens of Germany University of Tübingen tells Verneminen. According to BBC News, Helen Briggs, the research doesn't fully discount climate change's contribution to cave bears' extinction. Instead, the new study posits that human hunting and habitat encroachment paved the way for losses expounded by factors including the onset of the last ice age and declining food sources, wear on the bear's teeth points toward a heavily plant-based diet. But as the Washington Post's Ben Guarino reports, more recent discoveries offer evidence that the bears also feasted on the bodies of their peers. There might be still a synergistic effect of both factors, human and climate, Schunemann explains to Guarino. Mitochondrial DNA, or mtDNA, shows that Europe's cave bear population was stable from 200,000 to 50,000 years ago. Per National Geographic's Verneman, mtDNA is inherited from one's mother and can provide information on past population sizes. But around 40,000 years ago, the species numbers started falling, and by 20,000 years ago, the animals had vanished completely. Crucially, Guarino notes several periods of cooling and warming occurred during the population stable period, but did not appear to have a significant impact on the bear's numbers, reinforcing the idea that humans were the driving force behind the species' extinction. Although Neanderthals lived in the same regions as cave bears prior to the arrival of Homo sapiens, Berneman writes that modern humans probably wielded more advanced hunting technology and were more likely to venture into cave bear territory than their older cousins. As new settlers killed cave bears, perhaps for their fur and meat, or because the animals were viewed as a threat, and moved in on their habitat, members of the species simultaneously faced obstacles such as an increasingly limited territorial range and a decline in abundant vegetation. Ultimately, the animals succumbed to a range of factors, chief among them human activity. We can't unwind the clock, taking humans out of the picture and see whether the cave bear survived or not. Axel Barlow, a biologist at Germany's University of Potsdam, who was not involved in the study, tells the Post. The emerging picture for cave bears shown by not only this study, but also decades of careful research, is that the influx of anatomically modern humans in Europe matches very well, both in timing and geographically, with the decline of the bear. Milian Sali is a Washington, D.C.-based arts and science journalist. She has previously served as Smithsonian's American Society of Magazine Editors intern and a Kiplinger.com editorial intern. Up next, the Washington Monument will reopen in September. The discovery of contaminated soil pushed the timeline back for repairs. There's an artist's conception of the new screening center. This is by Jason Daly. On September 19, the Washington Monument on the National Mall will reopen to the public, who will be able to ride an elevator to the top to get the best view of Washington, D.C.'s most famous sites. For much of the last decade, visitors have only been able to gaze at the structure from a distance. On August 23, 2011, a 5.8 magnitude earthquake, a rarity for the East Coast, cracked the monument, displaced bricks, and damaged the internal elevator. The shake prompted an almost two-year closure and $15 million repair work. For much of that time, the monument was surrounded by a chain-link fence and had scaffolding surrounding the spire. The structure reopened in May of 2014, but nearly 2 years later, the monument was forced to close to tourists again when a cable on its elevator snapped in August of 2016. The aging elevator already had a history of previous incidents, and Michaela Lafrac at WAMU reports that the Park Service decided it was time to overhaul the entire system, modernize its control system, and add audiovisual screens into the cabin. It awarded a contract to a Maryland construction company in September of 2017 to get to work on that and a visitor screening center outside the monument. A temporary center had been erected soon after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, but it was never replaced with a permanent structure. The whole project was scheduled for completion in the spring of 2019. However, the discovery of contaminated soil in the area of the screening center pushed that timeline to August. Now the Park Service announced it will officially reopen to the public on Thursday, September 19. According to a press release, same-day tickets for opening day and all tours through August 18 will be available on a first-come, first-served basis, starting at 8:30 a.m. at the Washington Monument Lodge, located on 15th Street between Madison Drive Northwest and Jefferson Drive Southwest, beginning October 10. Visitors can secure tickets via www.recreation.gov for tours starting October 19 onward. The monument will be open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. I know there was a lot of information packed in there. You can always listen to a replay of this on our podcast page at NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. The National Park Service has not elaborated on what contaminated the soil found at the site, but said it poses no public health risk. About 250,000 cubic yards of earth were deposited in the area in 1888 to create the knoll that the spire sits on. Architect Pierre L'Enfant's original 1791 plan for Washington, D.C. included a spot on the National Mall for a monument to George Washington. In 1833, a society formed to design and raise money for the monument. Construction began in 1848, and by 1854, the monument reached a height of 156 feet. The project was temporarily scuttled when allies of the anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, conspiracy theory-minded Know-Nothing Party took over the board of the Washington National Monument Society in 1853 and drove it into bankruptcy. The Civil War and its aftermath kept the project from getting back on track until 1876, when Congress took over the work. In 1885, on the day before George Washington's birthday, the monument was finally dedicated. At the time, it was the world's tallest building at 555 feet, 5 and 1/8 inches. It also boasted a steam-driven elevator that got people to the top in 10 to 15 minutes. For the dedication, orator Robert Winthrop wrote, "The storms of winter must blow and beat upon it. The lightnings of heaven may scar and blacken it. An earthquake may shake its foundations, but the character which it commemorates and illustrates is secure." Next, Earth's quietest place will drive you crazy in 45 minutes. Inside the room, it's so silent that the background noise measured will drive you crazy, by Rose Eveleth. Everybody seems to be looking for a little peace and quiet these days, but even such a reasonable idea can go too far. The quietest place on Earth, an anechoic chamber at Orrfield Laboratories in Minnesota, is so quiet that the longest anybody has been able to bear it is 45 minutes. Inside the room, it's silent. So silent that the background noise measured is actually negative decibels. Stephen Orrfield, the lab's founder, told Hearing Aid No, I think that's a brand of hearing aids, "We challenge people to sit in the chamber in the dark. One person stayed there for 45 minutes. When it's quiet, ears will adapt. The quieter the room, the more things you'll hear. You'll hear your heart beating. Sometimes you can hear your lungs, hear your stomach gurgling loudly. In the anechoic chamber, you become the sound." But the room isn't just for torturing people. Companies test their products in it to find out just how loud they are. And NASA has sent astronauts to help them adapt to the silence of space. For you and me, however, the room is a deeply disorienting place. Not only do people hear their heartbeat, they have trouble orienting themselves and even standing. How you orient yourself is through sounds you hear when you walk. In the anechoic chamber, you don't have any cues, Orrfield told the Daily Mail. You take away the perpetual cues that allow you to balance and maneuver. If you're in there for half an hour, you have to be in a chair. So the next time you wish for some quiet time, remember that it could also drive you crazy. Rose Eveleth is a writer for Smart News and a producer, designer, science writer, animator based in Brooklyn. Up next, "Why the Sun Was So Quiet for So Long" by Sarah Zelensky. Our sun goes through cycles of activity, on average, every 11 years. At the height of a cycle, the sun is a busy place, with flares, eruptions, and sunspots. At its lowest point, the sun is quiet. That quiet period usually lasts for about 300 days, but the last solar minimum stretched for 780 days, from 2008 to 2010. Scientists have proposed plenty of explanations for the lengthy solar minimum, but it's remained somewhat of a solar mystery. Now scientists report in Nature that change in the flow of plasma within the sun were responsible for the lack of sunspots. The sun contains huge rivers of plasma, similar to Earth's ocean currents, says Andre Muniz Jaramillo, a visiting research fellow at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Those plasma rivers affect solar activity in ways we're just beginning to understand. The astrophysicist created a computer simulation of the sun and ran it through 210 solar cycles, varying the speed of the plasma as it cycled between the equator, and the poles. They found that if the plasma was moving quickly in the first half of the solar cycle, but more slowly in the latter half, the result was an extended minimum and a weak magnetic field, also a feature of the last solar minimum. There might be one small problem with the model, though. It may match the last solar minimum, but it doesn't match up with what's going on with the sun right now. The sun will ultimately tell us how to resolve this conflict, because only it knows what the next cycle will bring, NASA solar physicist Madhulika Guhathakurta told Wired Science. And Sarah Galinsky is an award-winning science writer and editor. She is contributing writer in science for Smithsonian.com and blogs at Wild Things, which appears on Science News. And for our last couple of minutes, we go to Ask Smithsonian. When did Americans start to worry that foreigners were interfering with U.S. politics? In the earliest days of the Republic, says John Grinspan, a curator at the National Museum of American History. During the French Revolution, a faction of conservative pro-English Americans worried that radical Jacobins who were beheading their compatriots in Paris would try to meddle in U.S. politics. That fear led to the 1798 passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts, which, among other things, tightened restrictions on criticism of the government and loosened those on deportation of non-citizens. The fear of meddling rose next in the 1840s, when the anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic Know Nothing Party saw new immigrants from Ireland as part of a papal plot to take over America. Why did the Vikings, who live in Greenland alongside the Inuit for several hundred years, not spread European diseases like the Spaniards did several hundred years later, writes Phyllis Schmutz, Neskonset, New York. Location, for the most part, says William Fitzhugh, director of the Smithsonian's Arctic Studies Center, when the Norse arrived in 985 and until they left in the 1450s, they settled in the southwest coast of Greenland, far away from where any proto-Inuit people lived. Starting around 1350, the proto-Inuit Thule people migrated to this region. But unlike in the Americas, where trade was frequent, there was minimal interaction and no cohabitation between Europeans and indigenous people in Greenland. European diseases like measles and tuberculosis made their way to Greenland in the 17th and 18th centuries as Denmark started to colonize the island. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. Once again, it's been my pleasure and privilege to read for you today. I always learn something new from our readings and hope you do too. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast will be available on our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's a new website address, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, address any comments or questions to us at 919-832-5138.